And welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Claire Wiley, and with me now is Dr. Joseph Wilson, who is a professor of biology at Utah State University and has focused research on the evolution and ecology of bees and wasps. Thank you so much for being a part of This Green Earth today.
Happy to be here.
Well, I wanted to first lay the groundwork on how you came to work in this field. I love the stories about a person's path because sometimes it was germinated in youth and sometimes a little later along one's journey. So what is your story?
That is a good question. I think I would say I was born a biologist. So my parents tell me this story from when I was around 2 years old. And my dad had heard that it's good for parents to like interview their kids. And so he sat me down as a two-year-old. I mean, I don't know how you interview a two-year-old, but he sat me down and he asked something like, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I said, I want to be a lion. And so even at the age of two, I was thinking about animals and nature and things like that. I fast forward to second grade and you fill out these little questionnaires about what your favorite food is and your favorite TV show. My favorite TV show all through elementary school was PBS Nature. I convinced my family to let me watch it. We had a rule of no TV on Sundays because it was a family day, but I convinced them that nature shows didn't count. So I was allowed to watch Wild America and PBS Nature and other shows like that. So I was always a biologist, but bees in particular came a little bit later in life. I guess I was always into insects. I grew up in kind of suburban Utah County. And I loved nature shows, like I said, but I didn't see that same excitement of nature in my backyard. I didn't have lions or gazelles or any of that fun stuff. I didn't even have squirrels, but I did have bugs. So I was in the backyard a lot, turning logs over and turning rocks over and collecting bugs and watching insects do their thing. And I realized there's a lot of nature happening in these little small parts of the backyard. There's predator bugs and there's prey bugs and there's all these dynamics that I would watch on those nature shows happening in the yard. So I've always been into insects. When I started college, I like a lot of biologically minded people, I thought I wanted to study big, charismatic, you know, bears or lions or things like that. But I met this girl who had just returned from spending the summer in southern Utah studying bees. They were doing a big study in the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument. And I started hanging out with this girl and she introduced me to the world of bees. She's now my wife and she actually got me my first job working with the USDA Bee Biology Lab up in Logan. Wow. So that's how I came into bees.
Well, that's such a great story. And I think that a lot of us can relate to that wild kingdom, those moments as a child. I remember being so into that as well, and that backyard ecology, wanting to go out into my backyard, being raised in rural Michigan, and doing the same things, finding those salamanders and finding all those creepy crawlies that were intriguing as a kid, and loving it. Now, my path diverged from there, becoming a biologist, but I think it's why I love this show so much, because I have such a curiosity about it. And I love the scientific minds that really wrap themselves around these different parts of our world and these different species.
For sure. I mean, it's kind of complicated because my research pursuits and my hobbies and my family interests, they're all kind of intertwined. My kids that are now teenagers now joke with me that all of our family vacations were centered around bees, which is kind of true. I always have a net in my car. I always have my camera with me, and there's bees all over the place. And so really, I spend my life looking for bees and learning about bees and kind of celebrating the beauty of bees, really.
Well, we are called the Beehive State, and from what I understand, there are more than 1,000 native species, roughly, of bees in this state. Is that true?
Yeah, it's amazing, right? I like to say, instead of thinking of the Beehive State maybe as the early pioneers thought of it as just celebrating the hard work, which is a great thing to celebrate, I like to think of it that we are a beehive full of the diversity of bees. We can emulate that as biologists. We have more bee species than most other parts of the world, but also we can emulate that as a community, that we can celebrate this diversity. I just did a study last year and we actually documented 1,167 different bee species in Utah.
Wow. And so when you break down these different species, what are the things that you look for that set them the most apart?
You know, it's pretty tricky. There is such a diversity of bees, it's almost hard to wrap our brains around it. So for example, a lot of people are into birds. Birds are really cool animals. There's, you know, communities of birders that go out every weekend and look for birds. There's about 1,000 bird species in the U.S. There's four times as many bee species in the U.S., 4,000 roughly.
Wow.
And so just the diversity of bees is kind of mind-blowing. There's some that are 2 millimeters long. There's some that are about an inch long. Some only visit sunflowers. Some only visit willow flowers. Some live in the ground. Some live in holes in trees. Most of them are solitary. Some are social. There's just so much going on.
So what are the bee species that you have spent the most time with and done the most studying on?
That is a really good question. So my bee research has really focused on broader questions, looking at patterns of diversity. So I haven't really focused down on one small group of bees as much as I have with wasps, but rather I have kind of looked at community dynamics, what kinds of bees live in one area versus another, and why maybe how can we attribute the differences in diversity, or what can we attribute those differences to?
So bees have been named the most important species of the natural world because they do so much for the planet. Can we talk through some of these species that you've looked into here in our own state that are so important for our ecosystems and for our very existence?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting because over the past 30 years or so, there's been a big shift in people's perceptions about bees. People used to kind of be scared of them and associate them with stinging and maybe honey. Now people are really recognizing this important pollinator aspect of bees. And we have really built our agriculture system in the U.S. Based on the European honeybee. It's the bee that we're, most of us are familiar with. It was brought over by the pilgrims to North and South America, you know, 500 years ago or so. That one's a really important bee because we use it in our agriculture systems. We bring trucks and we move them around the country, and there are negative effects of this, but it's an important pollinator. But a lot of new studies are showing that these wild bees actually do as much or more of the pollination in many of our agricultural settings, especially in backyard gardens, in small orchards. And then the wildflower communities are pollinated almost exclusively by these wild bees. Many bees have really close relationships with the flowers that they pollinate. Some of them have physical characteristics that make them really good at pollinating certain flowers. And many of them just have a preference for certain kinds of flowers. We call them specialist bees. So there's one in particular that the common name is a squash bee. Squash, not like squishing it, but squash meaning the squash plant family, pumpkins, mm-hmm. zucchinis, things like that. This bee only collects pollen from squash flowers. And so when you go out to your pumpkins or your zucchini plants this summer, if you go early in the morning when those blossoms are open, you see these bees moving rapidly between these squash flowers. They're a native bee, and they do the majority of the squash pollination.
That's so interesting that many species only service a single plant family. And if you've got 1,000 different species, that makes a lot of sense because they have a very specific role. And you hear the term worker bee a lot, and you talked about that's a nod to the state's beehive vibe. But it does seem like they are a species that was born to work for the planet.
Oh, well, at least that they're born to work, and the work they do helps the planet. I make the distinction because the bees are just working for their offspring.
True,
and
yes.
That work benefits all of the plants that they visit, but they don't really have the plants in mind necessarily.
Sure, they are looking at this as survival and how they take care of themselves and their offspring. And in a more global aspect, we see the benefits to what they are doing. So
exactly.
You say some of your vacations have been spent based on bee research. What is it that fascinates you the most about perhaps even a certain species, something super unique to them that you find especially fascinating in the bee world?
Yeah, there's this one group of bees that's it's not a super rare bee. The genus is Diadasia. They don't have, they have multiple common names, but there's roughly 30 species or so in this genus, and they're all specialist bees. Some of them only visit sunflowers. Many of them only visit globe mallow flowers. Globe mallow is this orange flower that we see commonly out in the deserts of Utah. What's interesting about these bees, and I've done some work looking at their different nesting sites around the state, they prefer to nest in really hard-packed soil. So you'll often find them in the middle of dirt roads or on hiking trails. And they're solitary bees. So a single female bee digs a nest by herself and then lays eggs in that nest. There's not a cooperative working like we think of honeybees. But these Diadasia often have large aggregations of nests. Each female makes their own nest, but there could be thousands of nests in a square meter. And what's cool about these little Diadasia is they often make little chimneys over their nest entrance. So it almost looks like a little adobe or a mud cylinder poking out of the ground. And if you see one of these nest aggregations, you can see thousands of these cylinders with bees going in and out. And I just think it's so interesting that they like these such hard-packed soil that you can't dig in it with a shovel, yet they chew through that soil with their jaws, use a little bit of water or nectar to moisten the earth, and then they build these, I think they're beautiful looking little mud chimneys over the nests.
Yeah, it is so fascinating how they operate. In talking about that particular species, can you break down their biology and their physical attributes that lend themselves to being maybe that strong jaw, or, you know, what's happening with their flight? How does that work?
Bees have a lot of really interesting, unique characteristics that most of us don't see, partly because they're so small. Often a bee, one of these wild bees, is less than a half an inch long, sometimes less than a quarter of an inch long. So these little characteristics, while really precise and really adapted to their purposes, they just get ignored by us often. So 70% of the bees in Utah and actually across the world are solitary ground nesting bees. Mm-hmm. So in the spring, a female bee emerges from her pupa she's been underground as a pupa over the winter. She emerges and she starts finding a place for a nest. She will use those jaws and her legs to dig in the soil. Different bees prefer different kinds of soil. They usually dig a tunnel straight down, anywhere from 6 inches to several feet down. And then they'll make these little side branches off of that tunnel, which become little nursery chambers. In each nursery chamber, she collects pollen and nectar and makes a little pollen cake that she puts in these nurseries and lays an egg on it, then seals it up. So after she does 6 or 7 of these little nursery chambers, she'll seal up the ground nest and fly away. So she'll continue to do this and make as many nests as she has time for about a month to 6 weeks. That's about how long an adult bee lives. So she'll do that for about a month. Underground, those eggs that she laid on that pollen hatch. They look like a little teeny maggot, and they eat the pollen and nectar that was left for them. It takes several weeks for that to happen, and then they pupate. And then they stay in this suspended animation as a pupa until next spring. So each bee has roughly a 1-year life cycle. About a month of that is as an adult, and then the other 11 months are as a larva or a pupa.
Wow.
Yeah, and we think of bees as being hairy. Many bees are hairy, and that partly is an adaptation to help them collect and carry that pollen back to their nests. Some bees carry the pollen dry, and they use static electricity to kind of stick it to themselves. Some bees will mix the pollen with nectar, make kind of a Play-Doh that they stick to themselves.
They are such fascinating creatures, and from what I understand, they also have recognition and can remember an individual human face. Is that true?
It's really interesting. So we often think of like the concept of cognition, kind of being self-aware or the idea of thinking as maybe a primate kind of idea. Monkeys and apes, we're fine with this idea that they're smart. But yes, bees also have really interesting intelligences. There are studies that show they can recognize faces. And this isn't meaning that, you know, the bee that you shoot away from your barbecue recognizes you and is mad at you. It's different than that. It's mostly just studies showing that the bee responds to the pattern. They often do this with pictures. So they'll show a picture of somebody and then feed the bee and train it that way like you would a dog. And then when they show the picture to the bee, it responds by sticking its tongue out or showing that it's ready for food. So it's kind of like a Pavlov's dog when they ring the bell and the dog salivates. It's that kind of experiment. But it does show clearly that bees recognize patterns, bees can recognize faces, and bees can make decisions based on those patterns, which is kind of interesting.
It's so interesting. We just talked to Joanna Bagnuska, who is part of a study that did use bees to track actually drugs. And that's how she described that there was that recognition of reward. Mm-hmm. And they would work for a couple days and then retire because their lifespan is so short.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a lot shorter than we think. And there are exceptions to this. The queen honeybee of the European honeybees, she does live a lot longer, but the workers have the same similar life cycle to these native bees that is roughly 6 weeks long.
So we know that people can pose quite a risk to bees and different ways in which we live and utilize pesticides. But bees are such a friend to a farmer. So how do we resolve that conflict of pesticides and bees and helping to conserve the very creature that is doing the farmer a favor, actually?
Yeah, exactly. And maybe even it enabling that farmer to make a living. It's a tricky balance because some of the things that are best for bees, like weeds, for example, often a diverse set of flowers to collect pollen from can lead to healthier bee communities that often can have a negative effect on the crop yield. If there's too many weeds, depending on the crop, you have less of a yield. Tilling, because 70% of the bees nest in the ground, if you till too frequently or too deep, that's going to disrupt the bees' nests and their life cycles, and you will have a negative impact on the bees. But if you don't till, then you can have that ground that gets totally covered with invasive plants, and that's also bad for the bees. So there needs to be this balance of managing our farmlands for their purpose, which is to produce a crop. But there's a lot of new research showing that you can manage them in more sustainable ways that benefits the bees and the farms. Often organic practices have been shown to have higher bee diversity, but not even just organic. Smaller mixed crop farms lead to higher diversity of bees. Rather than just big monocultures, you know, 200 acres of one crop, if you do mixed crop style farming, you support more bees. Also, the margins of the field, there's a lot of studies. In Europe, they do more hedgerows when they purposefully plant rows of different kind of plants and shrubs in between the crops, and that really also benefits the wild bee communities.
And what can we do just in our own backyards to help mitigate any issues for bees or to keep a healthy ecosystem for bees in our own world?
That is a great question, and this is something that I've kind of been preaching for 20 years now. So our backyards don't have to be the opposite of nature, right? We can have our yards be part of nature. Mm-hmm. There's lots of small steps we can take, and there's big steps we could take if we are up for it. But bees need two things. They need food and they need nesting habitat. Food means flowers, and not every flower is good for bees. The bees that are indigenous to Utah have a close relationship with the flowers that are also indigenous to Utah. So native flowers are good for native bees. And I often recommend planting native flowers. But also other non-native flowers can be useful for bees, especially like in July in Utah, especially in the lower elevations, there's not a lot of native flowers blooming. So studies have shown that if you mix your flower garden, a mix of natives and non-natives, so something is blooming all the time, you support bees across the whole season. So flowers is one thing we can do. Even if we just plant one flower in a pot on our porch, that is has the potential to help some bees. Nesting habitat is a little bit trickier. With 70% nesting in the ground, many ground nesting bees like bare patches of soil. And most gardeners don't like bare patches of soil because bare patches of soil often are associated with weeds. I encourage people to use drip irrigation systems, especially in their flower gardens, so you're not watering the bare dirt, because then that reduces the weed growth. And then hand-picking weeds rather than spraying them with herbicides is more precise, and you're not disrupting the soil as much. And so these native bees that are likely nesting in your yard can continue to nest there. And then the other 30% of bees that are not ground nesting bees, naturally they nest in pre-existing cavities. In nature, that would often be a fallen log that has abandoned beetle burrows in it or other little holes and crevices. And so if we want to take a step beyond planting flowers and leaving bare soil, we can add to our landscaping structures that can provide habitat for these cavity nesting bees, whether that's stones or logs, or sometimes people recommend making something called a bee hotel. It's basically a block of wood with a lot of holes in it. They are not the best solution, but they are better than nothing because these cavity nesting bees will nest there. And without the bee hotels and without fallen logs or piles of rocks, many of the suburban landscapes across Utah are not providing habitat for these cavity nesting bees.
You've been in this field for a while now. How are you seeing bee populations in their either fluctuation, or is there a decline that is alarming in any way?
That is a great question. With thousands of bees to look at, one of the most common questions I get is, are bees disappearing? And I often try to reframe that question. I like to give bird examples because I like birds. If somebody came to you and said, oh, I heard that birds are going extinct, you might ask, well, which kinds of birds? Which ones are we talking about? You know, are hummingbirds going extinct, or is it seagulls, or are we talking about crows? Like, we need more information here. And that's the same thing that's happening with bees. When you hear a statement like bees are disappearing, the question should be, well, which bees? Most of the studies have been done on the European honeybee, which isn't a wild bee, and it's more of an agricultural commodity. And there are declines in European honeybees, but there's also expansion of European honeybees as more and more people become beekeepers. There's also studies on bumblebees, those large black and yellow fuzzy looking bees that we see. Some bumblebee species across the U.S. have declined dramatically, up to 90% in the last 50 years, like 90% fewer than we saw 50 years ago. Other bumblebee species have expanded their range, and we see them more often than we used to see them. But for the vast majority of bumblebees and wild bees in general, we just don't have enough data. In order to estimate declines in populations, we need to have before and after data, the trending data, to see what these trends look like. And bee populations do naturally fluctuate quite a bit, but we just don't have the data to know which species are in decline, which species are not, for over 95% of the bees in Utah and across the country, really.
Yeah, it is interesting that you put it that way, because there is so many different species to take into account. Mm-hmm. I would assume that the research and the data is a long road to really understand it, because there are so many different factors and things to take into consideration.
It's a great question, but it's a hard scientific problem. How do we really measure changes in bee communities over decades and try to account for all of the changes that happen in those decades, including things like climate change, but also habitat changes and other things like that? And how do we account for natural variation when we aren't sure what the natural variation even is?
Well, there is, I feel a million more things to discuss with you, but our time will not allow. So I don't mean to put you on the spot, but will you come back and talk to us again on this green earth in the near future?
So we can. I would love to. There's so much to talk about bees. We could do it for hours, I'm sure.
Absolutely. There's so much to discuss with you and so many more questions that I have to ask, but we're going to have to leave it at that for now. But we will have you back. It's Dr. Joseph Wilson, who is a professor of biology at Utah State University and has been researching the evolution and ecology of bees and wasps. And we will definitely have you back on the show. In the meantime, there's a website that you put together. Can you tell us about that and how people can learn more about you and your studies?
Yeah, I mean, so I have a website called The Bees in Your Backyard. I think it's thebeesinyourbackyard.com. And honestly, I haven't been very good at keeping it up to date. I have a blog on there, but mostly I've been putting things on Instagram and Facebook. And I don't mean to plug social media because often social media is a waste of time, but there are good resources to learn about bees. And I try to have a mix of educational content on there, but also just lots of pretty pictures of bees because bees are beautiful.
Absolutely. What's your Instagram handle?
The Instagram is the bees in your backyard with underscores under each word.
Well, we will look you up. We will follow you. Until next time, thank you, Dr. Joseph Wilson, for being a part of our day today on This Green Earth.
Thank you.